round of 62. Mark Tompkins reports.
Well, there's very much a South African feel to the top of the leaderboard after day one of the Joburg Open. Nick Henning, a fine round of 62, sees him at the top, 9 under par after a great round on the West Course. And Eagle 3 saw him at 4 under par through his opening 3 holes, and that really set the tone for the rest of his round. He's one shot clear of another South African, Titch Moore, who got a hole in one on the par 3 fifth, and the Belgian Thomas Peters, who's also at 8 under par.
That's the end of our sports. Stay tuned to Channel Africa and back to Lulu Gabu.
Rise and shine. Africa, Africa, Amuka na Unga.
That wraps up Africa Rise and Shine at this hour. For myself, Lulu Gabu, and the rest of the team, thank you for joining us. For comments about our show, send us an email at info@channelafrica.org or tweet us and follow us on Twitter at Rise Shine Africa. Taking us to the top of the hour for the news and another hour of Africa Rise and Shine on the frequency 15255 kilohertz from the 19-meter band to far West Africa is Thabo Khanyile with a song titled Sponky Ponky.
Africa, Amuka, na Unga.
and welcome to Africa Rise and Shine. This is Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, coming to you live from Johannesburg in South Africa. We are on the frequency 7230 kilohertz on the 41 meter band to Southern Africa, and on 15255 kilohertz on the 90 meter band to Far West Africa. I'm Lulu Gabu in studio with Onelen Zinti, Tabiso Nohoko, and Tami Kuza. In our top stories on Africa Rise and Shine at this hour, Lesotho heads to the polls tomorrow for parliamentary elections and concerns over humanitarian situation in Gaza. In economics, South Africa's Telkom to resume second stage of the restructuring process. And in sports news, Mali beat Guinea to set up a CAF under 17 final with South Africa's Amajimbos. That's up the news with Onelen Zinti.
A suicide bomber has killed at least 17 people at a bus station in northeast Nigeria's Borno State. A military source says a second bomber tried to detonate his explosives at the same bus station at the town of Beu. However, a crowd stopped the suspect and beat him to death. The use of suicide bombers has become a common tactic of Boko Haram. But in the past 3 weeks, it has begun to suffer a string of defeats in a military offensive by Nigeria and neighbors Cameroon, Niger, and Chad. Villagers have been fleeing their homes in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo as the army pursues Rwandan Hutu rebels in a new offensive. Troops have captured all positions of the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda around Mulenge since it launched the offensive 2 days ago in the Uvira territory of South Kivu province, according to military spokesman General Leon Richard Kasonga. An update told, the troops of the National Armed Force have killed 3 fighters in the FDLR, which is currently believed to number between 1,500 and 2,000, and captured eight rebels. The Trade Union Congress of Namibia has urged all workers who do not have land or housing to support today's planned mass application for land. The mass action will take place countrywide in Namibia under the affirmative repositioning campaign, which suspended SWAPO youth leader Jacob Amopanda is spearheading. Tricky Valens has more.
Duma President Maongora Kawiwa says that this action is not politically motivated, but merely a social action aimed at addressing much-needed basic rights, in this case, access to land. He says politicians' anger about this current action should not be directed at the organizers, but rather at themselves. It is an open secret, he says, that there is no land scarcity in Namibia, only lack of political will to share the resources with citizens.
The South African Embassy in Zimbabwe says it is overwhelmed by the number of Zimbabweans applying for study and special skills work permits this year. Hundreds of Zimbabwean students continue to queue outside the embassy, hoping to secure visas weeks after most universities opened. Many universities have set today as the deadline for the students to arrive or have their places cancelled, despite the fact that a four-year tuition fee and accommodation have been paid. South Africa's ambassador to Zimbabwe, Vusi Mavimbela.
The number has doubled.
Another 100% increase of the number of people who are applying. And our capacity to handle those numbers has not increased. We still have the same capacity. But also people need to understand that it's quite a laborious process. So it's not a question of you submit your application today and then it's printed and then it's ready tomorrow. There's a lot of background information that has got to be done by the embassy to check whether those documents are authentic. And there are quite a number of cases where actually some of those documents are not authentic.
And finally, foreign shop owners in South Africa, Dobsonville and Soweto, say they fear for their lives after all their shops were closed yesterday. The South African Civic Organization sent a letter to the community members telling them about the closure of the shops. They are the same community members that went on the rampage looting foreign-owned shops after a 14-year-old boy was shot and killed allegedly by a shop owner last month. Pelma Kubane has more.
Locks and chains in the shop belonging to foreign nationals following a call from Sanko. Sanko claims they operate illegally and that it is the community that called for the shops to be closed. However, some foreign residents say they want the foreign shop owners to return as their prices are more affordable. It's alleged that a group of young community members were driving around in vans, intimidating the shop owners before the closures. The situation is calm at the moment.
Channel Africa News.
Africa, rise and shine. Africa, Africa, Amuka na Unai.
Thank you, Onele. It is 8:06 Central African time, and you're listening to Africa Rise and Shine. We're coming to you live from Johannesburg in South Africa. Regional observer missions are hopeful Lesotho's much-anticipated elections will go smoothly. More than 1.2 million Basotho are going to the polls to choose a new government. The elections were brought forward by 2 years to end the political impasse that saw an attempted coup last year. South Africa has been mediating the political crisis, and the hope is that tomorrow's election will stabilize Lesotho. Bonelo Lekafula reports from Maseru.
Head of the African Union Observer Mission, Raila Odinga, says they have met with various stakeholders, including political party leaders, the judiciary, and His Majesty King Letsie III. The former Kenyan Prime Minister says observers have been on the ground for over a month. He says despite a few challenges, the nation is ready for the polls.
Generally, what we are trying to find out is the state of preparedness for the people for these elections. We have also met with the officials of the Independent Electoral Commission. The impression we are getting is that there are some challenges, but by and large, there is adequate preparations for the elections on Saturday. We do think that the playing field has been leveled and that we should have free and fair elections on Saturday.
Meanwhile, the Electoral Institute of Southern Africa, ASA, led by former South African IEC chairperson Pamti Kakula, has expressed optimism that the Saturday election will be credible and free.
I think Basotho are ready to cast their votes on Saturday, and they want to do that and have committed themselves to doing that in a peaceful environment. And we are all hoping for a free and credible election, and we are also hoping that the outcome will be accepted by all the political parties.
And His Majesty King Letsie III has been kept abreast on all developments. The king's younger brother, Prince Seiso Berengseiso.
I can honestly say that His Majesty has been properly briefed by the IEC on a regular basis, and has had occasion to meet on arrival the heads of the various observer missions, and they too have reassured him that the SADC mission, the Commonwealth, and the EU mission are here to assist Basotho and Lesotho in every way possible.
As many as 1,116 candidates are contesting for the 120 parliamentary seats. And in the streets, people say they cannot wait for Saturday's election. Konelo Lekgafola, Maseru, Lesotho.
The refugee crisis related to Syria's protracted conflict is changing and approaching a dangerous turning point. That was the message conveyed to the UN Security Council by the High Commissioner for Refugees, who warned that the continued growth in displacement was staggering as the protection space available in neighboring countries shrinks. With the levels of need inside Syria augmenting the crisis posed by 3.8 million refugees, it has not only become the largest refugee emergency under UN mandate today, but the biggest humanitarian crisis of our era. Sharon Bryce Peace reports.
In 2013, Antonio Guterres predicted Syria's war would unleash the worst humanitarian crisis of our time, posing a terrible threat to regional and global peace and security, risking, as he put it, an explosion that could engulf the entire Middle East. He regretted in his address to the Security Council that he was right.
Well, over half of Syrian refugees in Lebanon are living in insecure dwellings, up from a third last year. And a survey of 40,000 Syrian families in Jordan found that two-thirds were living below the absolute poverty line. One father of four compared life as a refugee to being stuck in quicksand. Every time you move, you sink down further. With humanitarian appeals systematically underfunded, there just isn't enough assistance to provide for Syrian refugees.
Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, and Iraq have borne the brunt of the human exodus from Syria. Guterres warned that the almost 2 million refugees under the age of 18 now risk becoming a lost generation, while urging European nations to scale up their efforts to rescue those who risk their lives to make it to safer shores. He also blasted the levels of international financial support.
The Syrian situation illustrates the inadequacies of today's development cooperation policies in a time of multiplying conflicts. To address these, bilateral and multilateral donors and international financial institutions should review existing criteria and priorities. It is absurd, for example, that Lebanon or Jordan have no access to World Bank grants because they are considered as middle-income countries.
The UN Humanitarian Division appealed for more funding ahead of a donor conference at the end of March, while urging the Council to show leadership to end the barbaric war in the country. The UN Assistant Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Kung Wa Kang.
Kuwait has generously agreed to host a third pledging conference for Syrians in need on the 31st of March. We need high-level representation at that conference and meaningful pledges that will make a difference on the ground. We look to the members of this council to show leadership to end the barbaric and brutal warfare in Syria. We are running out of words to describe the terrible human and humanitarian consequences.
He warned that parties to the conflict continue to kill civilians and target civilian infrastructure, including vital services such as water and electricity, in blatant disregard of previous Security Council resolutions. I'm Shervin Bricebees in New York.
It's 8:13 Central African time, and you're listening to Africa Rise and Shine. We're coming to you live from Johannesburg in South Africa. Palestinians have suffered inordinately, and the global community has failed Gaza, according to the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA. In a joint statement, 30 international aid organizations, including UNRWA, say they are alarmed at the limited progress in rebuilding the lives of those affected by conflict in the coastal enclave. 6 months have passed since a ceasefire on the 26th of August in 2014 ended over 7 weeks of fighting between Israeli forces and Palestinian armed groups in the Gaza Strip. Stephanie Kutrick spoke with Chris Dennis, a spokesperson for UNRWA, and began by asking him for what the 30 agencies are urgently calling for.
Enough is enough. 6 months on, people have suffered inordinately. The pace of reconstruction has been very poor and very slow. Since July, the situation has deteriorated dramatically. Approximately 100,000 Palestinians remain displaced with the winter. The temperatures have been absolutely freezing. There are power cuts for 18 hours a day on average, which of course means that there's real problems for heating. The continued non-payment of salaries of public sector employees and the lack of progress on the part of the national duty government, that's increasing tensions. There are severe restrictions on the movement of 1.8 million residents who are trapped in this tiny coastal strip. Bearing the brunt of the suffering of the most vulnerable, of course, including the elderly, people with disability, women, that, you know, nearly 1 million children who live in Gaza, they're experiencing unimaginable suffering. They've had three major conflicts in 6 years. Children lack access to quality education. Over 400,000 of them need immediate psychosocial support. You know, the list goes on. Things are absolutely terrible, which is why we chose to speak out as we did.
Now, the statement says the international community must not fail Gaza and that Gaza must be made a livable place. What is the first step to achieving this?
Lift the blockade and allow imports and exports. That's so doable and so important. Of course it's important to reconstruct Gaza, and we have a mechanism in place which, you know, slowly is beginning to work, and, you know, there is movement there. What we have to have happen is the freedoms restored to Gaza so that we don't rebuild a place but keep the majority of the population suffering the indignities of aid dependency. And to do that, you know, they need a disposable income. They need to import things, make something, and export it at a profit. So we need to lift the blockade for both people and for exports and allow the free movement of goods in and out of Gaza, and of course the free movement of people.
Now, sporadic rocket fire from Palestinian armed groups has reportedly resumed. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, you know, we're not a ceasefire monitoring operation, but yes, I mean, there has been, you know, rocket fire out of Gaza, which, by the way, we always condemn. And people sometimes complain, particularly Israelis, that I'm never condemned the rockets. Let me condemn the rockets. We condemn them. And by the way, unlike many people who criticize us for not condemning them, we condemn them inside Gaza during the war. So, yes, it's worrying. You know, why should 6 million Israelis be subjected to barrages of these very inaccurate weapons? At the same time, though, it can't be used as a justification for the collective punishment of 1.8 million people, more than half of whom are children.
Now, Chris, you're a spokesperson for UNRWA. You're speaking on behalf of the millions of people suffering inside of Gaza. What do you think their main message is to people listening to us today?
We've suffered enough. The international community has failed Gaza. We have to realize the vision of making Gaza a livable place and a cornerstone for peace and security in all of the region. With a rising tide of extremism across the Middle East, I mean, by the way, you know, it used to be extremists in Afghanistan and Pakistan people would talk about, well, you know, now it's happening here on Israel's doorstep. And this continued blockade and de-development of Gaza is...
And that was Chris Gannis, a spokesperson for the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, speaking to Stephanie Kutrich.
Africa, rise and shine. Africa, soul. Africa, amuka, kanye.
Okay, it's 19 Central African time, and you're listening to Africa Rise and Shine, coming to you live from Johannesburg in South Africa.
Africa Rise and Shine. Africa. Africa.
There continues to be mixed reactions in South Africa to the revelations contained in the spy cables that have been leaked to international news agency Al Jazeera. A former top spy fans fears that the country's intelligence services are unequal to the task of protecting the country are exaggerated. But those mentioned want answers to why their own government would spy on them. The leaked documents emanating from the world's top foreign intelligence organizations, including South Africa's State Security Agency, have dominated headlines, throwing the spotlight on a secretive institution. Busi Chimombe reports.
State Security Minister David Mashobo is livid at the leaking of the spy cables and has instituted an investigation into who and what is behind them. Ms. Sobel says there's nothing untoward about classified communications with other agencies, but says the leaks undermine national security.
We work as intelligence services around the globe. We do cooperate on a number of issues, whether it's economic issues, it's issues of peace and security. It's not abnormal about intelligence services in the world to be something correct, because all of us have one common agenda to secure our state, ensure that we have world peace and order, but more importantly, that we develop in the world.
But head of Greenpeace, Kumi Naidoo, is not convinced. He says he is hurt and disappointed that he may have been the subject of surveillance by the South African State Security Agency. According to Al Jazeera X, South Korea had asked South Africa for information on Naidoo and called him a potential threat ahead of the G20 summit in Toronto, Canada, in 2010.
One of the agenda items for South Korea on a bilateral basis was to push their nuclear technology to other countries, and in particular they were looking at South Africa, Turkey and India to encourage them to buy nuclear technology from them, very much in their own interest. And I believe that they didn't want that voice to be heard in the halls of the G20 conference, and they were looking for a basis to deny me entry into South Korea.
Naidoo is taking the matter up with Masobo with the help of the Legal Resources Center.
Just this morning, I'm talking to the Minister of Intelligence, expressing my concern and requesting an urgent meeting based on his availability. Essentially, what I would like to hear from my government is that while we did not collaborate with the South Korean intelligence and share that information, and secondly, I would like to have a confirmation that I'm not a subject of surveillance and monitoring.
Minister Masobo has defended his agency's credibility, reminding the nation that they have averted a right-wing threat and stopped an assassination plot against the ANC leadership at the party's national conference in Mangaung. However, some have raised concerns about how secure the country really is, with the leaked documents' revelations of security lapses in every department, including the presidency. Former spy boss Barry Gilder, who retired in 2007 from the sector, believes there is little cause for alarm.
The impression is given through these leaks that, you know, somehow, what was the term used, that we were El Dorado or espionage. That's a complete exaggeration. The truth is, with the birth of democracy in 1994, because of South Africa's position on the continent and the uncertainty that many countries had about what the new government would be doing, there was a lot of interest in us, and the diplomatic presence grew exponentially. And along with that, and as part of normal interstate relations, the intelligence presence is a thing.
Gilder says he is confident in the ability of the country's intelligence machinery to scupper foreign espionage.
But I certainly think that the leaks that I've seen so far don't speak to me to problems in the service. It's obvious from ones I've seen that they are looking at these issues that are on top of some of the issues that have been leaked. But as I say, it's very difficult to judge until I've seen more of those leaks.
The leaks have put a spotlight on how far intelligence services go in their work, geopolitical relations between Pretoria and other nations, and the individual's right to privacy and dignity.
And that report by Busi Chimombe in Johannesburg. Zambian President Edgar Lungu says the talks he held with visiting Tanzanian President Jakaya Kikwete will go a long way in strengthening relations between the two countries. Kikwete concluded his two-day state visit to Zambia yesterday. Arthur Skopo has more from Lusaka.
Tanzania's President Jakaya Kikwete on Thursday ended his two-day state visit to Zambia. During his visit to Zambia, President Kikwete held bilateral talks with his Zambian counterpart Edgar Lungu at State House and was also hosted for a state banquet. The two presidents discussed matters relating to Tanzania-Zambia Railways,
Tazara,
Tazama Pipeline, the Dar es Salaam Port, Tunduma na Konde border, among other issues. President Kikwete said the two countries are aware of the challenges that Tazara is facing.
Then, of course, we undertook Tazara, the challenge of to assist us. As you rightly said, it has served our countries well, going through difficulties, and the kind of people gathered around this table have the capacity to discuss those issues invalid the way forward.
Tanzania head of state added that his country and Zambia are also working towards finding ways of revamping the operations of the Zama pipeline to ease the transportation of crude oil between the two countries.
And of course, there's the movement of oil through the port of Dar es Salaam to Mbeni refinery.
And dollar.
We have this as a joint project. We are balancing the shareholders. Whatever we can do to make sure that jointly, make sure that Tazama is functioning well, is something that we have to undertake. We use the opportunity, this opportunity as well, to discuss any issues related to it. First, I would like to assure our Zambian brothers and sisters that providing minister service to Zambia that is landlocked. It is your territory. You have a right over that territory. So whatever way you see we can do to provide services to us, to Zambia, President, please take it, let us know. Areas where there are difficulties, just let us know. That's why I brought in my team. We have these broad areas of cooperation. We have to facilitate trade. I'm glad you mentioned the Tunduma Anaconda transit point. We need to smoothen matters. Yeah, let us discuss on how to smoothen matters. Those issues that are pertaining to Tanzanian side, just let us know. Now on the Tanzanian side, we also see advice on the things that we think can be done by our two countries to make sure that things are moving on well.
In Zambia's president, Edgar Lungu, praised the relations that the two countries have enjoyed.
The foundation of our strong bond was cemented by the founding fathers of our country's memory, Dr. Kenneth Kaunda, popularly known here as Kweku, and your own, Dr. Mwalimu Julius Nyerere. Our task in this regard as president is made the more easier by our common heritage we have stated and the fact that our people share similar aspirations.
President Kikwete has since returned to his own country, reporting for Channel Africa in Lusaka, Zambia, and outside Skopo.
Southern Africa is known to be a relatively peaceful region, but human rights in the region, like in many parts of the world, are under threat. At the launch of its annual World Report on Human Rights, international lobby group Amnesty International yesterday highlighted emerging patterns, incidents that have taken place in the region where people have been criminalized for exercising their rights to freedom of expression, assembly and association. Celine Ndobon attended the launch and filed this report. At the top of the list of human rights violations is the recent attacks and looting of shops owned by foreign nationals in South Africa. The latest spate of attacks began in the south of the city of Johannesburg last month. This after a foreign shop owner shot and killed a local 14-year-old boy, claiming that the youngster had tried to rob him. The incident sparked widespread looting of most foreign-owned businesses in the township, forcing foreigners to move out of the area. The incident spread to other townships across the country. Amnesty Southern Africa researcher Mary Rainham says although not as severe as cases saw in the year 2008, the attacks were still as bad and questions of the political leadership of South Africa in this respect.
All of them perhaps are threaded through with the impact negatively or positively of effective political leadership. The South African state has an obligation to respect, protect and fulfill the rights that are there in the country's constitution as well as in the international human rights instruments which South Africa has ratified.
In Swaziland, Begi Temba Makubu, editor of Swaziland's monthly news magazine, The Nation, and human rights lawyer Tulani Maseko, were detained last year after highly irregular legal proceedings. They were arbitrarily arrested under defective warrants, denied access to their lawyers, and remanded in custody after summary proceedings held behind closed doors. They remain behind bars. Nuo Kututwa says the arrests are further evidence of Swaziland's intolerance of freedom of expression and that this violates international human rights standards and has no basis in Swaziland's domestic law.
Amnesty International considers these two as prisoners of conscience and continues to campaign for their immediate and unconditional release. The rule of law and access to effective measures of protection of human rights continued to deteriorate, and as a consequence, the continual undermining of judicial independence. Journalists, lawyers, independent-minded judges, trade union officials and parliamentarians were threatened with violence, arrests, persecution, or other forms of pressure as a consequence of their advocacy for human rights, respect for the rule of law, or advocacy on political reform.
Amnesty says the use of torture in Zimbabwe persists where pro-democracy activists have arbitrarily been arrested and beaten by police or non-state actors. The organization's director for the Southern African region, Deprous Mutela, elaborates.
The journalist and pro-democracy activist, Itai Damara, was brutally attacked and beaten by the police as he was leading this pressure group, the Occupy Africa Unity Square Group, which was planned for the stepping down of President Mugabe. So four others of this same group on the 26th of November were also beaten and detained and were severely tortured. And we continuously get reports of systematic torture, systematic intimidation and ill treatment taking place in Zimbabwe.
Other countries in the region that feature on the report are Zambia, where the leader of the opposition Alliance for Better Zambia, Frank Walia, was arrested and charged with defamation for allegedly comparing President Michael Sata to a sweet potato during a live broadcast. He was later acquitted. In Angola, investigations have found that police continuously use force to suppress peaceful demonstrations, also carrying out unlawful killings against some of the people who challenged President José Eduardo dos Santos' 36-year-old rule. Reporting for Channel Africa, I am Sidina Ndobo.
Our headlines up next with Onele Mkinti.
Nigeria's President Goodluck Jonathan has visited the scene of what is here to be Boko Haram's worst massacre yesterday and vows that the insurgency would soon be over. Villages have been fleeing their homes in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo as the army pursues Rwandan Hutu rebels in a new offensive. And feuding parties in Lesotho's ruling coalition will face off tomorrow in early national elections staged in a bid to restore stability 6 months after an attempted coup. Channel Africa News.
Thank you, Onele. Going back in time in history to today in 1980, the first multiracial elections are held in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, after a civil war between ZANU-PF and Rhodesian government forces, supported by South Africa's ANC and the South African government, respectively. Nationalist leader Robert Mugabe won a sweeping election victory to become Zimbabwe's first black prime minister. Let's listen to his reaction after the election results.
Oh, I was really overjoyed, and I felt overwhelmed by the victory that we scored. But at the same time, I felt humbled because this is not a victory at a soccer match, more than a victory even in the battlefield. It's a victory which confers upon you a tremendous responsibility, and the weight of that responsibility is really overwhelming. I'm humbled by the support that the people have given us. I did expect that we would win. I knew the people supported us. I knew they supported those who had a fought national struggle, whom they believed had contributed immensely to their own freedom and to the situation which has arisen.
That was Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe speaking after an election victory in 1980. That was Today in History. It is 8:35 Central African time, and you're listening to Africa Rise and Shine. We're coming to you live from Johannesburg in South Africa. The African Union applauds Liberia for opening its borders and the returning of 20% of the country's households following the Ebola outbreak. These improvements were announced last week by Liberian President Erwin Johnson Sirleaf. The announcement was made shortly after the schools in the country reopened following 7 months of closure. The AU has vowed to remain committed in assisting the three Ebola-affected countries in the region. For more on this issue, we're now joined on the line by the Press Secretary of the African Union Support for Ebola Outbreak in West Africa, Joseph Mungwari. Good morning, Joseph, and welcome to Africa Rise and Shine.
Good morning, Lulu.
Now, Joseph, first things first, the reopening of schools and people returning to Liberia. This is seen as positive development following the Ebola outbreak. Can you briefly explain what this speaks to?
Thank you very much. It is quite motivating for all of us who are working towards the eradication of Ebola. It is good news in a sea of bad news after the Ebola epidemic struck the West African region of our continent. And we feel quite motivated. It all started with a group of 86 health workers some 4 months ago being deployed with the height of the crisis. And we feel so much is happening, so much progress is happening. And it motivates us to continue working even harder. It motivates Africa to work even harder and to be more focused towards the eradication of Ebola.
Now, Joseph, can we really say that the Ebola epidemic is now under control in Liberia?
We commend the resilience of the people of Liberia. It is because of their relentless efforts that these positive developments are possible. The African Union and its 54 member states who are leading the fight against Ebola remain committed to the fight of Ebola. We believe there's still more work to be done, and the progress that is happened at the moment is quite commendable. We thank our health workers on the ground. We thank the Africa individuals. We thank Africa as individuals and as a continent for the work and the support they've been giving us through the HMS campaign and all the donations we've been receiving.
Now, there have been mixed reactions to the reopening of schools. Some people are saying that it is a bit too soon. Others are saying it's taken too long. What is your stance on this?
There always be mixed feeling in such regards, but the honest truth is there is so much progress that has taken place in Liberia. We believe we are not out of the traffic, but we believe we are in a transition, we are in a new phase, where honestly, quite a sad scenario when 7 months children are locked away from schools and their lives continue to move every day. And it is important that when we feel, and I'm sure it's now time when we have to give them their opportunity and their right to education. And people will say it's too soon. People will say it's too late. And when is it the right time? We feel this is the right time for schools to start opening. But we have really turned the tide in a very good way.
Now, I know that we're really supposed to be discussing Liberia, but let's just move away from Liberia and move on to, I think it's Sierra Leone, where there is a slight increase in the number of people who are now being diagnosed with Ebola. What is the situation there? What exactly is happening?
There is a spike on the numbers. The numbers have increased slightly over the past few days. But it is the nature of illness, the Ebola virus. I think at the moment, while the numbers seems to be slightly increasing in Sierra Leone, but across the region, the general numbers have stabilized. We continue to have a few moments of the numbers, in as much as we can suppress them down, as the numbers will continue to shoot here and there. But it's nothing out of this world, considering where we have come from. I'm sure in the next few days, we'll be talking of the numbers reducing once again. I'm sure in Liberia, we're turning the arc. In Guinea, the numbers are stabilizing. person to think that he's in Sierra Leone for some time, but we'll continue to work with the government on the ground and the people to continue to suppress the numbers down. And I'm sure we're almost there.
Joseph, the issue of, there's been information out there with regards to the spike or the rise in the flu, the cases that have been reported, for instance, in Sierra Leone. The fact that the disease takes about 3 months, about 90 days, to get out of an individual system, mainly the males. And on the female side, it takes a shorter period, and, people have been asked to not engage in sexual activity or to use protection. Is the message being received out there, the fact that you are not out of the woods at least for 90 days for males, and females is a shorter period, but are the people heeding the call?
I'm sure the people are heeding the call. We have to rewind it back. The situation where we are in, we are at a much, much more better position than when we were 3 months ago. And it is simply because whilst they are efforts to treat the health workers, to treat the Ebola-affected individuals on the ground, there has been so much education and training, public awareness exercise going through. But still, the turning of the arc is simply an indication of how the training and public awareness campaign is going through. So the call is being hit. There's been so much support. There's so much information that we've put on the ground. And we feel it's very well received. And we're happy with the progress so far.
Joseph, as you say, progress so far, really good. A lot still needs to be done in these countries that have been severely affected by the Ebola outbreak. In looking at the impact of the outbreak economically, socially, can you just elaborate on this and how these countries are going to get assistance from the African Union?
The African Union remains seized after Ebola progress and social economic recovery of these countries. And it is important that even after the Ebola crisis, we continue to build resilient and strong health system in these most affected countries. There is a mantra we have developed where we are saying, never ever again shall we hit by any other epidemic unprepared as we are as a continent. We are saying, moving on, as a nation, we now need to have an Africa Center for Disease Control, which proactively deals with how we respond with such scenarios. And over and above that, I'm sure by just turning the tide, by just declaring these nations Ebola free at some point, it is on its own the beginning of a recovery. And African Union will continue to support in every way possible these nations for their economic recovery.
And finally, Joseph, this was definitely a wake-up call for the African continent. And looking at health facilities on the continent, a lot of work needs to be done. What is the plan going forward to ensure that, as you say, never again?
The plan is clear. We now need to move it to the best practices in the world. We need to develop an Africa Center for Disease Control, which spends all of its time, which core business is to continue assessing and recommending in all our health systems. It's not only going to be the Africa Center for Disease Control that's going to be important. We need to engage our African private sector. We need to, it's all going to take money at some point. We need to continue strengthening the recently launched Africa Foundation, a partnership of the African Union and the African business sector. We need to move into the best practice. We need to leverage and benchmark on what has been happening in all the other continents in terms of how they have modeled their centers for disease control. That is the only way we can build a sustainable and we can achieve our never again policy towards epidemic situations unprepared.
Joseph, thank you so much for joining us.
That
was Joseph Mungwari, Press Secretary of the African Union Support for Ebola Outbreak in West Africa, on the line from Zimbabwe. It's 8:45 Central African Time, and you're listening to Africa Rise and Shine. We're coming to you live from Johannesburg in South Africa. Our economics update up next with Thabiso Lehoko.
South Africa's telecommunication provider Telkom has announced that it will resume with its second stage of the restructuring process next week. Spokesperson Jackie O'Sullivan says the telecommunications utility has a first stage of the turnaround process, which focused on top and middle management, started 2 years ago and was concluded in September last year. O'Sullivan says the remaining stage is about consulting labor unions as the process affects their members.
Our primary objective has been to try and improve the future of Telkom to create a sustainable organization. However, we're very aware of the circumstances we see in this country where unemployment is such a huge issue. So our first priority is to try and see how we can save jobs. And one way in which we see we can do that is to look at outsourcing operations. That, in many respects, is going to be an important solution for us to try and find a way to keep people in roles but to still deliver the efficiency that we need to make Telkom sustainable for the future.
O'Sullivan says that the contemplated Telkom consultative process will include all the three recognized unions in Communication Workers Union, Trade Union Solidarity, South African Communication Union, and the Information Communication and Technology Union. However, on Wednesday, ICTU said the Johannesburg Labour Court had halted Telkom's planned retrenchment of more than 100 workers. The union brought an urgent application against the telecommunications service provider. O'Sullivan says that the ICTU will be consulted when the process starts.
The consultation process has not yet begun. When it begins, and we believe that we're hoping that that will be next week, the ICTU will absolutely be included. There's no question about that. The law requires it. So the only areas where the ICT cannot be involved is where we have engagements happening that are outside of consultation. However, the actual formal consultation, they certainly will be there.
Interest to invest in Africa by foreign financiers is reportedly on a steady surge despite the high business risks the continent faces. This is according to the chief executive officer of the Lesotho National Development Corporation, Kiriboni Lesenyane. Lesenyane was speaking at a two-day workshop hosted by the LNDC to sensitize local business stakeholders on how to mitigate business risk. He told participants that the main objective was to discuss mitigating business risk, which he said affects investment climate in the country. People in East Africa are awaiting a Chinese-built Standard Gauge Railway project set to run from Kenya's coastal city of Mombasa to Rwanda's capital Kigali through Uganda. It is expected to cover a distance of about 2,936 kilometers, featuring passenger trains with a speed of 120 kilometers per hour and freight trains designed to move at 80 kilometers per hour. Many African people are upbeat about the prospect of good results once the railway project is completed. Teachers in Rwanda have been urged to embrace the small businesses to complement their salaries. The Director of Public Service Management and Promotion at the Ministry of Public Service and Labor, Alexis Ntakumira, has made the call in the capital Kigali while opening a two-day annual meeting of the National Teachers Union. Ntakumira says teachers have been complaining about their salaries, saying it is not commensurate to current market prices. Oh. Indicators at this hour on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance. The US dollar trades at 11.54 South African rand, 9.53 Botswana pula, 6.95 in Zambia, 0.64 British pound, 0.88 across the euro. Gold at $1,209, platinum $1,173 an ounce, Brent crude $60.77 a barrel. Deep pocket, short hands. Economic update.
Thank you. Thank you, Tabiso. Our sports update up next with Tammy Guza.
Thanks for joining us. Good morning once again. Let's start with soccer, where Mali beat Guinea 2-1 to complete the equation for the final match of the 2015 CAF Under-17 Championship. The Malian Eagles will now face South Africa's Emma Chumbos on Sunday at the Stade Fene Kunche in Niamey in Niger to determine the junior title holder of African football. With the win, Mali will now face South Africa on Sunday for their right to be crowned new African junior champions. All four semi-finalists will carry Africa's flag at the FIFA Under-17 World Cup to be hosted by Chile from the 17th of October to the 8th of November this year. Nigeria's coach Stephen Cash has disclosed he has finally received a new contract from the Nigerian Football Federation, the NFF, and he is starting it. And even though Cash was not forthcoming with details of the deal, the former Malian Togo boss dismissed claims of salary slash. Cash says that the NFF have offered the same amount he was earning when he took the team to the World Cup in Brazil. And Ghana will grace the 2015 COSAFA Cup as guest team and have been handed a group stage bye in May event to be hosted by South Africa. The Black Stars have replaced the three-time COSAFA Cup champions Angola, who opted not to take part in this year's edition of the Southern African Regional Football Championship. The 2015 Afra Cup runners-up will face winners of Group B that consists of Lesotho, Madagascar, Swaziland and the second guest team Tanzania. Meanwhile, defending champion Zambia awaits winner from Group A with a potential quarterfinal date against Zimbabwe awaiting them. Other teams in the race to face Zambia from Group A and Namibia, Seychelles and Mauritius. Both South Africa already know their quarterfinal opponent after they were drawn against Botswana. Malawi and Mozambique will clash in the other quarterfinal draw. South Africa will host the tournament in the Northwest Province from May 17th until the 30th. Now, good news in cricket. South Africa won the toss earlier and chose to bat against the West Indies in the World Cup Pool B game at the Sydney Cricket Ground. It looks like things are coming all right. The score now is 292 for 4 after 44 overs. It's a crucial game for the Proteas after they lost by 130 runs to India, while the West Indies are confident following their 73-run win over Zimbabwe. And this has left AP de Villiers' team with just 2 points after two games and trailing India, the West Indies, as well as Ireland in Pool B. Now, currently there, the score is 312 for 4 after 45.1 overs. Thanks very much. The hell in rugby, South Africa will include 7 9 white players and their 23-man squad ahead of the 2015 World Cup. At least two of the 7 selections must be black Africans. The South African Rugby Union side says that the selection criteria forms part of a plan to raise black representation, with non-whites making up half of the all domestic and national teams by 2019. SARU's Chief Executive Officer Yuri Reed stressed the move to expand black participation is not a quota system.
No, it's not just the Springbok team, but I say, give us the opportunity to address all of the other issues. You know, the reality is that we get probably criticized the most on the way we play the Springbok team and
how we play, and then
style of rugby and the members of the team, and if you select the team, everybody's got difference, and then everybody's got excuses on why we win. Our school structures are not great. We're letting the players go. You know, we don't have coaches. We don't have enough coaches. We don't have enough players.
And finally, with golf, day one of the Joburg Open has concluded with South Africa's Nick Henning leading the way after a fine round of 62. Matt Thompson's report.
Thanks very much. South African field to the top of the leaderboard after day one of the Joburg Open. Nick Henning, a 5-62, sees him at the top, 9-under par after a great round on the West Course. And Eagle 3 saw him at 4-under par through his opening three holes. And that really set the tone for the rest of his round. Here's one shot clear, another South African, Titch Moore, who got a hole in one on the par 3-5th, and the Belgian Thomas Peters, who's also at 8-under par, and they were joined later on in the afternoon by Tjaart van der Walt, who also shot a round of 63 on the West Course. The West Course providing the best scores today. The best score on the East Course, Wally Cotsia, down in a tie for 8th place with a 66. And a mention for the Englishman